from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, how old are we as a species? That's the central question Stanford professor Robert Polk Harrison poses in his most recent book, Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age. The book is all about Western cultures retaining juvenile characteristics through adulthood and extending them into the cultural realm. Youth and wisdom, where do they intersect? Or do they? Robert Polk Harrison will join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. Robert Polk Harrison is professor of Italian literature and chairs graduate studies at Stanford and is the author of Forests, The Shadow of Civilization, The Dominion of the Dead, and Gardens, an essay on the human condition. He also blogs for the New York Review of Books, hosts a Stanford radio program called Entitled Opinions, and plays in an alternative rock band called Glass Wave. His most recent book is called Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age. Joins us for the second hour here in studio, and welcome back. It's been a long time since you've been here on Forum.
2008.
Yeah, you got it nailed. Well, glad to have you back. But everybody here is saying, what's juvenescence? And maybe we ought to get past that, first of all.
Well, it's the opposite of senescence, I suppose, which is the natural course of things, that we get older through time. Juvenescence is the word that I chose to describe what I take to be a dramatic social and even biocultural phenomenon that we're living through in our era, which is the way in which our society, as well as many of the individuals inside of that society, are getting younger in the last couple of generations in ways that would have been inimaginable to even our more recent predecessors of a couple of generations
ago. When you say our era, we're really talking about post-World War II, aren't we? Looks, behavior, so-called lifestyle, although I always like Susan Sontag's line about if you have a lifestyle, it doesn't mean you have a life, right? It's just a style. But all of this suggests a desire to stay youthful, to be youthful.
Not only stay youthful against the odds, but there is a way in which we become more youthful at various different levels. And this is why one of the things I felt I needed to explore in my book is in order to explain how is this sort of juvenescence possible at all is our evolutionary biology and our evolutionary history. And I learned from Stephen Jay Gould that this phenomenon known as neoteny had a crucial role to play in our hominization. What is neoteny? It's the way in which in our morphology, we have managed to retain several youthful or juvenile characteristics in later stages of adult development.
These are actually juvenile features in the adult organism. I remember talking to Gould about this.
Exactly.
And so it's biologically taking place, it's culturally taking place on a wide scale, not only here in the United States, but really Western civilization?
Yes, and I think I would insist that there's also something in our species that favors all forms of juvenescence insofar as childhood and our prolonged infancy remains the center of gravity, I believe, for almost every adult, psychologically speaking. There's this way in which youth is retained up until the day we die. That's what I tried to give the term cultural neoteny for the cultural forms that this sort of retention of youthful characteristics takes. And therefore, I believe that what we've experienced in the post-war period that you were referring to, especially in America and Americanization, is possible because there is a biological substrate in our species that favors this process. And in fact, Stephen Jay Gould, when he visited Stanford shortly, before he died, believed that it was completely plausible, this thesis of mine.
Yeah, making me miss Gould, my favorite guest through the years. But you get into larger questions about really youth being vital for cultural innovation and for drive. And And yet wisdom, as you say, is handed down in legacies from the past. So as a species, we may be evolving into, I think you talk about we've transmuted evolution into culture and we've transmuted culture into evolution.
Well, exactly, because if you think of how what a luxury human infancy and childhood is in terms of the 30% of our lives being spent in a state of childhood dependent on others and so forth, that has obliged us to become mature or wise or kind of senile in the non-biological sense in a way that has created the institutions of human society and human culture and has given us a cultural maturity that has been the counterbalance to this youthful exuberance that is part of our story as well. And I suppose I worry in our present day and age that we might have been that what I call wisdom as opposed to the genius, the youthful genius of the speech versus the senile wisdom, that wisdom is being thrown for a loss. And
we're getting cut off from millennia that preceded us,
yes.
In effect.
Yes. And we actually don't know.
A case of arrested development culturally, maybe.
It could be. And we don't know whether a society can actually survive on genius alone without wisdom. Because I don't know of any precedents for such a society. We may well be forging or be on the cusp of such a society as we speak.
You speak about wisdom. You quote Hannah Arendt, who defined wisdom as loving concern for the certainty of the world. I don't know, things nowadays seem so uncertain, you know, almost ubiquitously uncertain. But wisdom becomes more and more difficult, I suppose, under the rubric of what you're writing about here to attain for us because we're more, again, cut off from the past and there's more or less of intergenerational continuity.
Exactly. And what Hannah Arendt refers to there is also what she calls amor mundi, which is the love of the world. And, of course, we live in a part of the world here in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, where there's such a dominant ideology of innovation and change and changing the world as the great cry of so much of the silicon industry. Hannah Arendt says that the world becomes inhospitable to human needs when it's constantly subjected to this wrenching, violent movement of change and constant change, that we need a certain degree of stability, intergenerational, so that the world of the elderly is still recognizable as their world. And that is the kind of stability and continuity that all the convulsions that have come about through really dizzying series of revolutions and innovations and new phenomena from the 20th century into our own time has endangered this kind of foundational stability of what Hannah Arendt calls the world.
Talking to Stanford professor Robert Polk Harrison about his new book, which is called Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age. As long as you brought up Silicon Valley and technology got me thinking a lot about changing the world. I mean, this is something that Bill Gates and Steve Jobs have been kind of almost evangelically putting forward for quite some time now. You know, we're connecting people, and all that's true. And yet there's another side of this. I mean, people are thinking they're changing the world by coming up with a new app which makes, you know, it easier to do something in terms of finding out where your friends are having dinner. This gets into sort of an absurdity, and it also tends to separate, of course, the generations even more.
Sure. It leads to segregation of the generations. And there's a big difference between inventing a new app of the sort you described and the process of cultural transmission of legacy, which is so much different than what we understand as connection or connectivity. We can connect ourselves globally and internationally with greater and greater speed, but it's not clear that that does anything to enhance or facilitate the process of cultural historical transmission by which legacies from the past are appropriated in the present and renewed and projected into the future and given new and younger forms for the future. So what I do worry about in the rush to push constant innovation and change is whether the true sources of renewal, a kind of genuine newness, is can thrive under these conditions.
We may also, I've alluded to this before on the air, be changing the whole neural pathways. So we are changing the world possibly with all the time spent with many of these devices. But I'm quoting you now from actually, I think, your blog in the New York Review of Books, where you said, Silicon Valley means at bottom new and more ingenious ways to turn my computer or smartphone into my primary and eventually my only access to reality. You're taking a position here which I can hear a lot of the software folks and the people in Silicon Valley crying, we are changing the world. You know, don't you realize that?
Yeah, but that's the problem, is that they're changing the world in ways that are maybe not thought through in advance. And frankly, some of us, a small minority of us, still have a great deal of doubt about whether reducing my whole experience of reality and making it pass through a screen, be it the laptop screen or the cell phone screen or the television screen, whether that's the kind of change that guarantees that we can greater fulfill our human potential. For me, it smacks too much of the Borg collective. For those of you who are old enough to remember the Star Trek series, where this constant connection, where you always have voices inside your ear from the hive and the collective, that what is it about this constant connectivity that prevents me as an individual, and me meaning any first person singular, from truly taking that kind of descent into the underworld of the past, where you hear the voices of the dead speak in their own other idiolects, and this kind of listening and concentrated attention, which I believe is the way in which historical legacies are transmitted to the future and renewed and given new form and have a future life. This, I don't deny that Silicon Valley high tech is every day changing our way of being in the world. Whether for good or ill, I'll let others decide.
Well, you also point out that youth today seem more depressed. We were just talking in the first hour about lack of sleep that young people have today, some of it tied to social media, other earlier classes and academic pressures and the like. But I was struck by your argument that youth are deprived of a certain kind of idleness and solitude, which is so important in reflective thinking because they're constantly wired.
It seems like we're a youth-worshipping society and that we're doing everything we can to stay youthful. But you're right. I argue that at one level, our society is waging a pitiless war against the very condition of youth, which requires, as you mentioned, idleness, shelter, the freedom to fail, a full-bodied relationship to nature, without which my being in the world, my being in the cosmos is essentially meaningless. This kind of freedom to pursue an idiosyncratic call of the self, all these things which require a certain disconnection from the noise of the collective, is part of the experience of youth that will then bear fruit later in human relations. And I do believe that we have made it more and more difficult for the young to be truly young in that sense.
Let me just read a passage, if I may, from your book, where you, apropos of what we're talking about here. One of the claims of this book, you write in your preface, is that our youth-obsessed society, in fact, wages war against the youth it presumably worships. It may appear as if the world now belongs mostly to the younger generations with their idiosyncratic mindsets and technological gadgetry, yet in truth, the age as a whole, whether wittingly or not, deprives the young of what youth need most if it hopes to flourish. It deprives them of idleness, shelter, and solitude, which are generative sources of identity formation, not to mention the creative imagination. It deprives them of spontaneity, wonder, and the freedom to fail, deprives them of the ability to form images with their eyes closed, hence to think beyond the sorcery of the movie, television, or computer screen. It deprives them of an expansive and embodied relation to nature, without which a sense of connection to the universe is impossible and life remains essentially meaningless. It deprives them of continuity with the past, whose future they will soon be called on to forge. And all of this is what we call juvenescence, yes.
Yes.
I mean, that
the dark side of
that,
it.
The dark side of it, the youthfulness of it, and it's deprivation. In the meantime, we're forging more, trying to live longer. You've got Ray Kurzweil and others at Google who are saying that why shouldn't we live forever? At the same time that all this biotechnology, plastic surgery, clothes that are probably not fitting the person who's wearing them or going on, and all the worship of youth culture, trying to preserve and maintain youth. You talk about looking, for example, at your father's yearbook. That was a very telling passage. It's the same as looking at people in the first world as opposed to looking at people in the third world, really, isn't it?
Yes. If I look at my father's yearbook, I see faces of fully grown adults. They're youngish, but they're fully grown adults, and the likes of which I hardly ever see among my own undergraduates today. So something has taken place there, even appearance-wise, I think also psychologically, mentally. And it's true that if you wander around certain villages in the third world, you can see 12-year-old boys that really look like weathered, highly seasoned adults in miniature form. And not to speak of the elderly in certain cultures in the third world, where they have these dignified, majestic, senile traits that in our first world, no matter how old we get, I don't think many of us ever acquire. So go figure.
Go figure, yeah. Indeed. Again, we're talking to Robert Polk Harrison, who is the author of Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age. You also write in your book about an imbalance between you say we're senile and we're puerile, with that kind of middle lost contact not being there.
Yeah, my book sets out to answer a very simple question that does not have a simple answer, which is how old are we in this particular age that we belong to, this cult, this historical era? And finally, in my epilogue, I try to answer that question through invoking two literary figures. One is Lolita, who, in my reading, represents a whole new strain of youthfulness.
Nymphet.
Yes, Nymphet. And Humbert cannot really understand the kind of cultural genome she belongs to because he comes from the old world. So her youthfulness, her children will be, even when in their old age, much younger than anything that people of the generation of Humbert would can imagine.
Should mention that Humbert is a would-be lover of Lolita. Yes.
Exactly. So on the one hand, Lolita is our reigning goddess. On the other hand, I invoke Samuel Beckett's novel Molloy. Lolita and the English version of Molloy were published in the same year. Molloy is this endlessly aging and old figure who can't quite die. So why do I invoke these two? Because on the one hand, we are a society that's never been younger in the history of humankind in ways we've talked about. On the other hand, we belong to a multi-millennial history, and we're getting older all the time. So on the one hand, we are older than we've ever been. On the other hand, we are getting younger than we've ever been. So it's this very difficult paradox that I try to address through a book that I have to say, when I started rereading sections of it in preparation for today, I felt a little bit bewildered myself because it's not simple to answer the question of just how old we are in our cultural age at present.
Well, we may hear from listeners in terms of their response to that central question. In our age and the age we're living in, how old are we? And what about this idea of juvenescence, the idea that we are trying to stay young in the wake of course, getting older and time marching on? And it makes for a real chasm between, let's say, youth, or what is perceived as youth, with full of innovation and drive and all that, and the legacies of the past, or the wisdom of the past, as Robert Pogue Harrison pretty much posits it. Let me bring you into this conversation, those of you listening, and let me invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your calls. That number, 866-733-6786. And please feel free to join us. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways you can communicate your thoughts or join the conversation or bring in questions or comments. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can join us simply by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. All that social media is available regardless of what your age is or regardless of where you are, at least on the chronological spectrum of – but people like to think of themselves as young. I remember I always used to like Twain's great remark, you know, age is mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. But, of course, he was wrong. It does matter.
It does matter. I'm not against people staying younger. I'm not against any of the those sorts of efforts to remain young. What I argue is that the where there is genuine rejuvenation, it's when youth takes on new forms of cultural maturity or even physical maturity, that you cannot just hold on to youth as something that is gradually disappearing and slowing down the process. It's how you can bring the forces of maturity and youth together to bring into being new modes of being a 60-year-old, in my case, or a 40-year-old. But with doing it without succumbing to a process of juvenilization, because I think the real antithesis to rejuvenation is juvenilization.
Well, you say at one point the storm of juvenescence, I like that phrase, leads us either to a genuine rejuvenation or juvelization of the culture. I mean, it's kind of an either or, isn't it?
Well, rejuvenation, the difference as I see it is that rejuvenation is recuperates, retrieves legacies from the past and renews them, gives them younger, newer forms.
Historical grounding and connectedness. Yeah?
Exactly. Whereas juvenilization just merely ignores the past. And juvenilization is a form of becoming the orphans of history rather than the heirs of history. Becoming the heirs of history and promoting the process of juvenation, I think, is the ideal that I would propose that we strive for.
I like that dichotomy, too, heirs or orphans. That works in many ways. But the fact is, we're in this youth-obsessed culture, as you point out, which ironically or paradoxically wages war against youth.
Yes, because there's not sufficient maturity in the juvenilization of this new form of juvenescence in order to find a way to actually give youth a wider sort of horizon where it can fulfill its true potential. So again, paradoxically, juvenilization is not the best friend of youth. On the contrary.
Now, is this one of the reasons you're in an alternative rock band?
Well,
stay young.
To stay young, no, because I was a rock musician earlier when I was young, and somehow that's what neoteny means. It means to hold on to something, some youthful thing, in later stages of development. And I have not surrendered that passion. And there's no reason to believe that someone at my age is just engaging in juvenile behavior when you go back and try to make a rock
album. I was just being a little facetious there. Glass Wave is the name of the alternative rock band, and they do everything from Annabelle Lee to Helen of Troy. You can go online and find out what they're all about. We're talking again to Robert Pogue Harrison, what he's all about right now. And our discussion is his most recent book, Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age. When we return, we'll hear from you on this. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Robert Pogue Harrison. He is professor of Italian literature and chairs the Department of French and Italian at Stanford, and is also the author of most recently Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age, Youth Obsessed with Newness for Its Own Sake. And that does alienate older generations. But this is more than just a generation gap. This is the idea of a culture trying to be young and staying young in antithesis or direct opposition, if you will, to senescence, which, by the way, Robert, also implies getting senile in many people's minds. But it's just really getting old.
It's true. It was hard to find a word that would be the right word that senile means in Latin, which means matured, seasoned, and in the fullness of age, let's say, rather than senile in the sense of decrepitude. So, but unfortunately, there are very few words in English that you can use in that, in place of senile.
Well, we had a program recently with Eve Pell, who's written about finding love, you know, in the 70s and 80s and even 90s, which she did and wrote about it in the New York Times and then got a book out of it where she talked to a lot of people. And she said, I'm comfortable with the world old, with the word old. I don't know why people are not comfortable with the word old. You know, it says you reach a certain chronological stage, and yet in many people's minds it's a pejorative. It's,
well, in fact, Hölderlin, the German poet, has had an epigraph to one of his books. He said, on no account do I wish the book were original, because originality is novelty for us, and nothing is dearer to me than the things as old as the world itself. In that sense, the word old, that's the right word.
I was also thinking, not necessarily thinking old, but I was thinking of a famous essay that many probably know of Thomas Stearns Eliot, T.S. Eliot, called Tradition and the Individual Talent.
Yes.
I mean, this was sort of putting forth, and it had a tremendous influence, the idea that tradition is important, but it's equally important to the individual talent. The individual talent in this case would be youth. Tradition would be wisdom, you know,
exactly.
As you set them off together. But they need to be connected.
Not only connected, the individual has to find a way to renew and rejuvenate that tradition. That's the process of cultural neoteny I try to describe in, you know, in broader horizon.
Let's bring our callers in, and we go first to Palo Alto, your home territory. Scott, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I certainly hope I'm speaking to your kind of a rather nebulous topic, but I wanted to try to address the question of how kind of old we are collectively. I think there's plenty of suffering to be had on the individual basis, but collectively, I don't think we even really need to look towards technology or the recent technological advancements or how 90% of us have our face stuck to a screen all the time. I think we could just look at things in our environment, like the fact that we still rely upon fossil fuels. We've got trash floating in the ocean. We still have a profit model for healthcare, and the fact that we, some of us, will go to war or kill for a piece of flag, you know, a flag, some conceptual idea. So I guess what I would leave you with is that, you know, especially in the Bay Area, we are so obsessed with new and novelty and authenticity that we need to look at the larger picture as the, what I guess Jung would say, is the collective age or the collective consciousness of humanity. And I think we're not just young, but we're quite primitive. And that's kind of maddening, I think, for some people in the world to realize that we're kind of stuck in this very, very kindergarten stage of conscious evolution for humanity. I don't know if I'm making sense there, but I just wanted to drop that on you guys. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you. You too. Thanks for dropping. Robert Hoke Harrison.
Well, I agree with the caller in the sense that our problems have become infinitely more complex of late, and yet our ways of thinking and relating to those problems have become, as you said, more primitive. We don't have enough. I agree that we don't have enough political and perhaps social and cultural maturity to realize the consequences of the actions and inactions that we sponsor. So, again, it's one more reason to take stock of that how important it is for us to act our age, not only as individuals, but as a society and as a political body.
Chris, when you say act our age, there are many associations with a lot of people's notions of what that age should be all about. I mean, it's probably really quite multivalent.
It is multivalent, but with regard to the ecological problems and the potential catastrophes that await us on that level, to act our age means to understand that we live in an age where these problems are extremely real and they require a response that it is adequate to those consequences, and that requires a certain kind of adult thinking about these issues, because a childish thinking about them only aggravates the problems.
And here's Frederick joining us from Calistoga. Frederick, welcome.
Good morning, gentlemen. I wish that we had the opportunity to take a few breaths after so much of your eloquence, the both of you, in addressing our human condition now. I'm a nearly 60-year-old man who was calling on a pop-open phone. The old technology works for me. I have for 20 years been coming out here from northern New England to the San Francisco Zen Center because of its deep, rich tradition. The tradition of the elders, the wisdom of relationship, I find, of relationship and constancy. I feel that your brilliant address, Professor, eloquently addresses the problem of commercialism and capitalism and everything being quantified in economics so that we're constantly changing and attempting to purchase our satisfaction, to buy our well-being, rather than looking at the relationships and the constancy born out of experience, out of practice, whether hopefully it's within one's own life, and I think that bears true wisdom, isn't wisdom that which is a learned experience which opens oneself to a greater truth.
Frederick, I think you're bringing up a greater point here, and I'd like to hear Professor Harrison opine on this. I mean, the idea of commodification, youth itself is being sold to us all the time by Madison Avenue and by what we see in advertising and the like.
Sure, and I don't deal with it that much in my book, but there's no doubt that capitalism, as the guest mentioned, is the kind of motor of certain forms of juvenilization, if not infantilizations, in the sense that it is always engendering desires, and desires in the infantile mode that you have to have it now and you have to have more of it and more, and that helps foment the kind of frenzy of desire, and it's bad infinity, to use a Hegelian term for it. The constancy that the guest referred to is something that is hostile to capitalism, because constancy is not – capitalism, I think, thrives on upheavals, constant overturning and agitation. So I'm in sympathy with those comments.
Yeah, I like Frederick, you're mentioning constancy here. It's a good concept to bring into this discussion, and I thank you for that. I'm going to bring somebody else in, and that's John. John, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Really glad you guys are talking about this. I've been studying this subject a lot. I just wanted to make a comment that I would strongly disagree that the younger generation is less wise because we have more technology. If anything, all of my peers seem to be constantly reading from the past and kind of expanding their own education, whether they're starting companies. I mean, our generation, the millennials, are kind of a generation of forced entrepreneurs. We've been like imposed a lot of hardships from the older generations. You know, we can't get mortgages. Our college educations are outrageous. Healthcare is super expensive. And basically every way, you know, we don't have pensions. We have 401ks now. So if anything, we've been forced to kind of innovate, out of the box. And I'd just like to say, you know, my generation, we can with a click of a mouse, look up history and read all about the past. And I think we do. We check the boxes on all the right issues. We're very egalitarian. We're anti-war. We're less consumeristic, much more kind of, I guess, of a socialist tendency in our generation. We're the generation that wants to go to space again. And when you look at what the baby boomers gave us, the hydrogen bomb, the lead in gasoline, lots of fossil fuels being sprayed into the atmosphere, DDT, I mean, you can just go on and on. It's kind of hard to say that the new generation is less wise than the old generations, and I just don't see it. So it just seems like future fear to me.
Well, appreciate your pushback on that, John, and thank you for calling. It's interesting that he mentions all those environmental things, because in your remember if it was in your book or one of your New York Review of Book blogs where you talk about young people who are environmental-minded, who are, you know, seeing that as a mission to heal the planet and right. Looking back at the past and realizing the damage that this caller just suggested, as opposed to, well, call them the techies or, you know, those who are concerned about or agitated about finding a new app or whatever.
Right. Well, I want to make it clear that I never said that the young are less wise today than we were when we were young or our parents were. That's I don't believe that, because I think history is forcing on the young a kind of wisdom just for the sake of survival, because that's the function of wisdom, after all, is to provide for the future, to look forward into the future. And if you're young today, you're looking forward in the future and you realize that you cannot just infantilize your way into it. Something has to be done. So therefore, I see even a kind of incipient wisdom among my students, even freshmen, that edifies me and it gives me a certain degree of hope that the young will take charge of their own maturation process against the kind of short-term legacies that the guest was referring to, which I agree with. On the other hand, I would say to that caller that the fact that, a click of the mouse and you can read all about the past, that reading all about the past in terms of the information of what the past was about is a far different phenomenon than what I insist on calling the mystery of cultural transmission of legacy and the renewal and retrieval of legacy. You do not retrieve legacies with a click of the mouse. You make them your own. You bring them into some kind of interior space of the mind and through concentration and lingering and dwelling on. You have to appropriate something like a legacy in ways that require time, depth, concentration, and a certain degree of idleness.
You mean you can't get heritage through a click of the mouse?
You can get information about the heritage. You cannot make that heritage your own.
Here's some emails. Jerry writes, I was a software engineer for over 40 years, half of it in Silicon Valley. I agree that too much change is dangerous, and I agree that people, including myself, spend too much time online. Maybe the emphasis on youth prevents the young from learning wisdom from their elders. And Tom writes, I'm a big advocate of staying young in terms of personal health and openness to new ideas. What I find unattractive about our current culture is a refusal to mature, which is evident when one sees 50-year-olds dressing like adolescents, baseball hats worn backward, look goofy but cute on teenagers, just plain foolish on older men. I miss the notion of distinguished older gentlemen and women. Let me read a few more emails here. Wendy writes, I'm always surprised that more companies don't hire older persons simply for their judgment and perspective, something hard won, usually with the years. This is not to say that any older person has good judgment, but it's more likely than not that they certainly have that perspective. Why do these qualities seem so little valued in our society and our workplaces? And Dan writes, has the last century created the first generation where children understand the world's infrastructure and technological landscape more than their elders? I spent a lot of time teaching my elders how the modern technological world works. When before in human history did adults need to lean on youth to better understand the world? I can't imagine a 15th century farmer asking his son how to use a particular piece of farm equipment. But indeed, there are lots of older people relying on their children and their younger people to show them the technology that they don't understand.
Well, let's keep in mind just how unusual is the fact that now, for the first time ever, youth is the model of emulation for the old. It's always been the other way around, where adulthood was the model of emulation for the young, and people were in a hurry to grow up because all the privileges and benefits lied with adulthood and not with childhood or youth. And now this perverse phenomenon where the young are educating the old, something fundamental has changed. And I agree that it lends more evidence to my claim that we live in an age of wholesale juvenescence. The phenomenon that we do not really understand very well at present. So,
but the older can be also terribly embedded and chained to the past. And
yes.
And not only that, but you have a good deal of erudition in your work, and you talk about King Lear, for example. And I think of Lear as just almost the quintessential foolish old man.
He's quintessentially foolish old man. He's fourscore and upwards in age, which means he's 80 plus something. So therefore, he's old. But
we learn a lot from his daughter, Cordelia, not the other two, not Reagan and Gunnar, about what youth should be valuing than we could possibly learn from Lear or those of his contemporaries.
Yeah, but what's interesting about that play is that Lear is not just biologically old. He belongs to an older age than his daughters and their coevals.
Is that true about many of older people today?
Well, it depends on how you define the ages. My theorist in this regard is Giambattista Vico. He said that there's an age of gods, an age of heroes, and the age of men. Lear clearly belongs to an age of heroes. He believes, I mean, for him, it's all about heraldry, ceremony, ritual. When he has that divestment ceremony, he expects from Cordelia some kind of ritualistic enactment that's appropriate for the occasion. She belongs to a completely different cultural age than he does and is all obsessed with sincerity. I can't say something that doesn't really correspond to the way I feel about it. Therefore, it's a misunderstanding. It's a conflict between two different cultural ages and not just biological.
This is what we have today, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is.
In a different form, perhaps, but still the same.
For sure.
Let me get another caller on here. Dorothea, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Very interesting program. I wanted to alert you guys to a development, the destruction of wisdom in the form of the destruction of libraries. I think our young people might think they can get their information from a click of a mouse only, but the reality is that books hold information that even hasn't been digitalized yet. But in Alameda County, for example, the librarians destroyed almost 400,000 books in the past 2 years. And this trend seems to be playing out all over the country. So the books get thrown out if they're not taken out in 3 years. And they get thrown out if they've been published before 2001, except maybe for classics. So we have this very strange thing going on, and it's worth noting because our young people will not have the legacy of our wisdom at their fingertips at all. So I wanted you to address that issue. It's quite disturbing. It's happening at university libraries as well. CSU is in the process of doing it right now. That means throwing books out. Some of them are from the late 1800s that are so valuable they're worth like $3,000 a piece. But the public hasn't woken up to this, and the policies guarding our books haven't been put in place. So I'll take your...
Well, the last time I talked about burning of the books, other than ISIS, was with Nicholson Baker when they were taking all these books out of the San Francisco Library and burning them because they didn't have the space for them. But there is a sense that you're destroying a whole heritage and...
There is a
books,
space
yeah.
issue, of course, naturally in libraries,
yes.
but our library system has to figure out how to store the books so that people who, for example, I have a friend who actually edited the Mark Twain letters. That's Robert Pack Browning.
Yes.
He says that just because a book, you know, he went to the public libraries to look for some Twain information for his research, and just because a book isn't checked out in 3 years doesn't mean it's not useful to somebody down the line who would like to write a book based on that information. So it's a very shallow way of determining what's important to the public in terms of information.
Yeah, Dorothea, I'm much obliged you brought this up. Let's hear from Professor Harrison.
Well, I sympathize, obviously, when it comes to the destruction of books. We all do. On the other hand, let me indulge a little bit of speculation from the broad cultural historical point of view. We have so many works of antiquity that it's almost like everything that we can know about ourselves insofar as we are human are in those books that come to us from Greek and Roman and Hebrew antiquity. Think of the fire that destroyed the Alexandria Library and how many books from antiquity we would still have in our possession had that library not burned down. Maybe, I don't know, if it's 3 or 4, 5 times as much as what actually ended up being handed down to us. At a certain point, it's a blessing in disguise because we cannot be smothered by such a weight of books and the memory that they contain. Because there needs to be a certain open space for kind of free thinking and thinking independently of the thought of our predecessors, to a certain extent, relatively speaking.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking about when I was in Dublin and went to Trinity College and the library there, I wanted to see the Beckett exhibit that they have, yeah. which is extraordinary. And there were so many books, you know, it was unfathomable and certainly, in a sense, impregnable. I mean, you couldn't have possibly read what was even on one shelf in a lifetime. But so, they sat there and people walked through and, oh, look right. at all the books, you know what I mean, without necessarily feeling that they could access those books or those books even being accessible.
Right. So it's a dilemma. I mean, yes, of course, I sympathize. Every book should be preserved somewhere. should be retrievable. On the other hand, the young cannot be smothered by this huge towering library that you're describing.
Towering of Babel, almost.
Yes.
In both senses of that word. Let me bring another caller on here from Redwood City. Maddie, you're on. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with parenting and how to shape a child's thinking in this respect. This is a topic that's affected me personally. I've always been a bit of an old soul, and I've always gotten along well with people older than me, and that's allowed me to gain a lot of wisdom, but it's also prevented me from truly living in the moment. And it's only until I had my first son, and now I have two boys, ages 8 and 6, that now I'm starting to think about how to shape their thinking and how much to really inform them. And I find that if it's too much, then while they have the wisdom to make better decisions at times, they can't really live in the moment and truly just, bask in what is happening. So I wanted to basically ask the panel about how to strike a balance between the two to promote healthy development in a child.
Well, thank you for the question. Thank you for making Robert and me into a panel. There's just the two of us here, but you want to address her concerns? Robert Pogue Harrison?
It's always a question of balance, so I appreciate it. It's frustrating to say that it has to be a question of balance because you would like to come down on one sort of prescription for how a parent should parent. And here in this case, I think it's a balance between the kind of freedom that a child needs to divagate and imagine and be alone, this kind of idiosyncratic selfhood, give full sort of rein to that on the one hand. On the other hand, it's important that the child also undergo the process of becoming the heir, as we said, not the orphan of history. And, I wish I had the competency, sociological or otherwise, to, provide kind of counsel on this issue. But unfortunately, I think it's outside of the realm of my authority.
Well, there's a listener named John who says, the recent film Boyhood is a remarkable, really brilliant artistic representation of time, childhood, adulthood, and our self-understanding of all that in the technology age. He talks about maturation in the family and ties it to that movie as well, which may win an Oscar. Carol from Sacramento writes, does juvenescence have an economic aspect? An affluent society can afford this lengthy focus on youthful behaviors, whereas an impoverished society has to focus on the basics of survival and reproduction in a shorter time cycle. I think that's right. Some pushback here. A listener tweets that this trend of youth bashing is a riot. Keep up the denial of progress.
Well, if there was a little more substance to that remark, we could take it under consideration, but
I don't think there's real youth bashing here, but that's why we have people adjudicating interpretations, so to speak. Here's a listener who says, I think juvenescence is most effectively achieved through nurturing our youth rather than competing with them. And I think we're all in agreement with that. Let me bring another caller into this. Patricia, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting conversation. I just wanted to actually raise the point that I think that youth wisdom, or respect for the elders is different for those like myself whose parents are immigrants, or we ourselves are immigrants, particularly immigrants who have suffered through atrocities. For example, my parents lived through the martial law and the atrocities that came with that in Taiwan. I've had students I've taught at UC Berkeley who have lived through ethnic cleansing of the Chinese in Indonesia. And in that case, there really is a respect for what the elders have gone through. And I also just see it in general among my students who are poor immigrants, say from Mexico and other areas.
Well, you're from Taiwan. Chinese culture has always had a kind of venerative attitude toward.
Actually, I'm from America. I was born in Boston.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said you were from Taiwan.
My parents are from Taiwan.
Well, there is a different attitude, I think, in Chinese culture, though. When we saw the Cultural Revolution, it kind of turned that on its head, at least in the People's Republic. But I thank you for that comment. I want to get another caller on here, and that's Tom from Half Moon Bay. Tom, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I think it's lovely work that Professor Harrison is doing and very humanizing. And I just wonder if he's familiar with Robert Bly's work on a very similar subject in his book, The Sibling Society, where I recall he noticed the same phenomenon of the faces in old photographs looking much more mature, even at young ages, chronological ages. And I think he was very interested in the transmission of culture through ritual and initiation in what we call primitive societies. So, you know, I just wonder if you're aware of that work, because I think it would be a very good dialogue with your work.
Do you know the work?
Yes, I do know the work of Robert Bly, and it's exactly right. Initiation, ritual. I remember a really wonderful program. I think it was called A Gathering of Men with Bill Moyers interviewing Robert Bly.
And we had him on talking about the need to embrace your father and all that. So it's a generational thing
It's
again.
A generational thing. And there's some things that you can only learn through certain kinds of forms of transmission. Yeah, so I definitely in dialogue with that.
Well, speaking of transmission, just one final email here that I'm obliged to read. This is from a listener who writes, I have to disagree that the present rate of change is unique. My dad was born in 1921, about the time that Thomas Edison, Nikola Tesla, and George Westinghouse were inventing electricity. He worked for Westinghouse before and after World War II and worked in electronics through the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Silicon Valley, from the light bulb to the microprocessor. That was a tremendous amount of technological change to keep up with.
It sure was. On the other hand, we got people who are born in the era of the cell phone and those who weren't. Huge chasm between those two. People who grew up with personal computers, people who didn't. The generation gaps are multiplying and proliferating enormously.
The book, again, is Juvenescence. Good conversation, Robert. Thank you for being with
us. Thank
you. Robert Polk Harrison, professor at Stanford. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, we thank you for listening. Thank you for your listenership. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.